So she's 14.
Yes.
Here's the thing. Does she do everything?
If she wants more money, she better ask.
There's not going to be any problems.
Exactly.
And she's 14 for sure.
Yes.
Laura.
Yes.
You're the man.
Hello, this is the Rational Face Podcast for yet another episode. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
And on this episode, we have a pretty heavy topic. Brian, when you hear the term or phrase sex trafficking, what kind of feelings or thoughts come to your mind?
Oh, jeez, I don't even...
Yeah, that's about how I feel about it, too.
We're in a foreign government. We work with the foreign government. We pretend to be one of those traveling people on a sex tour. We're going to go after these bad guys, anywhere they are. We're going to find them. We're going to root them out. We're going to pull these kids out. The typical sting is to do like the bad guys do. They sell kids. They sell kids for sex.
Listeners, what you're hearing is the audio from a trailer for a movie called The Abolitionists.
I knew that night that the rest of my life would be spent rescuing and saving these little girls.
The Abolitionists was made by following Tim Ballard, who founded the Operation Underground Railroad organization, which saves children from sex slavery. We were able to interview Tim and talk about how he got into the business of rescuing children and shutting down sex slave shops. To hear his story and to be a part of the change that must happen, keep listening. Well, we have another podcast, and this one, as Brian and I have talked about, this one is a lot heavier content than what we normally talk about on the podcast. But we're really excited to be able to talk with Tim Ballard. Say hello to everyone, Tim.
Hi, great to be here. Hey,
glad to have you, and glad to learn from all that you have to teach us on this topic. And I have Geralyn Poole joining with me today. Geralyn, say hello to everybody.
Hello.
Before we get started, we're talking about this really heavy subject of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and this topic comes up in pop culture, it comes up in the news, but it's even in mainstream media, it's something difficult to talk about, I think. So I'd like to start off, Tim, with your experience in this area. We will get to how you got into this, but let's start off trying to understand what this is and what the battle is all about. So give us just a bit of a framing. What is sex trafficking? What is this? I hate to use the word industry, but it really is an industry. What is sex trafficking in this modern age?
It is, you know, I think when you get down to it, in a way people can really understand it, it's slavery. That's a term people understand better than trafficking. It's really the same thing. When one person, in essence, owns another person and uses that person as a property to make money. And this is a human trafficking is a $92 billion a year business. So it is an industry. It's a dark, gross, perverted industry. Slavery, we're talking about slavery, by most studies come in at over 25 million people in slavery today. this is slave labor. This is sex slavery. And oftentimes, you know, if you have one, you have the other. And about half of those, so roughly 10 million or so, it's estimated that, and these are from the State Department, this is from the UN reports, roughly half of those slaves, or a little under half, about 10 million or so are sex slaves. These are people who are being sold for sex. Of those 10 million, it's estimated that 2 million are children, are minors.
How do we define a minor?
A minor is defined as someone under 18 years old. The average age, though, in practice, it's much younger than that. Very few jurisdictions would prosecute a case with 16 or 17 year olds, simply because it's hard to prove that the John would have known that. So when we talk about child sex trafficking, the ages we're seeing mostly are between the ages of about 8 years old and 13 years old. And so that's kind of what we're talking about in practice, even though legally it is, you know, a 16 or 17 year old would fit the bill as well.
And is that worldwide, or is that specific to the United States?
That's worldwide. Worldwide. When you get into the United States, there's approximately 100,000 child sex slaves, or, you know, kids forced into commercial sex trade here in the United States. It's estimated that 8,000 foreign children, again, we're talking about the minors here, not the adults, but 8,000 are smuggled into the United States every year and forced into the commercial sex trade. The United States, because of that, sometimes people think, well, you know, we have such, there's a lot less, relatively speaking, of these of these sex slaves in the United States and more outside. But the U.S. is right smack in the middle of this problem because we are the consumers. And that's the sad truth, the gross truth. There's more child pornography consumption in the United States than any other place. And the sex tourists, these are people who go over and engage in the child sex market overseas or even domestically. I mean, these are Westerners. They're Americans. They're Western European folks. And that's why, you know, me and my team, when we go into these foreign governments and foreign countries, and we work in the United States as well, but one of our great assets that we can offer to our government partners is to be that American face and go undercover. These traffickers overseas, they will sell to us much, you know, more readily than they would to sell to a foreign a national, because they're used to catering to Americans. So we go to, we just show up to the right place, working with our government partners. We show up to the right place. We don't even have to ask. They're just going to come up to us and offer us children.
Ooh.
So how do these children get into? How are they? How are they being exploited? How are their parents selling them? How does this? It boggles my mind how a child would get into this. Obviously not of their own volition, but how do they get funneled into this awful system?
You know, a lot of people saw the movie Taken, and
yeah,
you know, it's scared a lot of people. Generally, that's not how it's done. A hard kidnap like that, simply because the response will be something similar to what you saw in the movie, right? You're gonna, if you just do a hard kidnapping of a Westerner, especially, there's gonna be a response. Traffickers don't want a response, so what they'll do is they'll go into some very impoverished places. For example, I worked a lot of cases where kids were being lured out of the indigenous populations of Guatemala. A lot of poverty there, and they'd go up there and they just find a family and throw a couple $100 at them and say, hey, we'd like to take your 10-year-old daughter to be a nanny, to take care of, you know, the kids in the city. You know, she's going to call you every day, or every weekend. You visit her. She'll be sending back money. We're going to take her to school. And these families get lured into it, yeah. And they send their child off, and that child's never heard of again. They never go to the city. They're taken to Costa Rica. They're taken to Colombia, and they're gone. And there's no repercussion here. I mean, this Guatemalan family can go to the police all day long, and there's not going to be a response because there's no trace. They left no phone numbers. They left nothing, or they left fake phone numbers. So you see a lot of that. You also see kids being trafficked right in their own hometown. And oftentimes it's also a lure. We had a case most recently, just a couple months ago, where this organization was posing as a modeling school. And they'd go to, this was in Cartagena, Colombia, and they'd go to these families and say that they'd like to train your daughter. And they target 9 years old when they started to get them into the school, quote unquote. And yeah, they did some modeling classes in the beginning. And then eventually they would introduce the child to pornography, give the child some drugs, and then start threatening the child, and then force the child to have sex with one of their clients, and then threaten the child's family, and say, you can go home, but if you tell your mom and dad what we're doing, you will be dead, they will be dead. Mm. And these kids don't talk. And that's something that's hard to understand. One of our, you know, EdSmart, works for Operation Underground Railroad, and Elizabeth is on our board of governors, and she can talk about this. And she, if you want to get that girl fired up, just tell her that, oh, that girl must have wanted it because she didn't tell mom and dad.
Right.
You know, Elizabeth has faced that kind of accusation because she had a police officer in the middle of her captivity come up to her, and she denied who she was because she was completely rewired by those monsters. And that's what those monsters do. They rewire these kids. So these kids will literally go home and not tell their parents. Sometimes the parents do know. Sometimes the traffickers say, hey, listen, we're going to pimp out your daughter and we're going to pay you $50 every time it happens. And the families are part. And that happens more than you can imagine. And I'll never be able to understand that or comprehend that. So it's really a mixed bag. Rarely, though, do you see a hard kidnapping because that's bad business.
Hmm.
Mm,
okay.
So that it makes more sense how it happens through different levels of deception.
Yep.
Is this a systemic issue? Like, are governments involved? How deep does this sort of thing go?
I've never personally seen where governments have actually been involved. If they are involved, it's going to be in a way that's so secretive, it'd be hard for us to see it. But for the most part, you know, the problem stems from two things. One, just a gross lack of enforcement on this issue. It's a dark thing. People don't mm-hmm. want to see it. They don't want to talk about it. It's the same answer as to why slavery existed in America for hundreds of years and good people did nothing. Because they don't want to see it. They turned a blind eye to it. And so that's what we've been for decades and decades dealing with is just a lack of enforcement. And so these traffickers work with impunity and they have for decades. So they're not scared. They just do it. And we're trying to change that, my organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. government has done phenomenal things in the area of trying to change that. Through their trafficking in persons report, which in mid 2000s came out, and it's a name and shame game where the U.S. State Department comes out and basically just ranks countries. Every country in the world gets a tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3 ranking based on what laws they have against trafficking. And mm-hmm. if you want the benefits that the U.S. government's willing to give you monetarily and otherwise, you better get to be tier 1. And so in the mid 2000s, all these developing nations where you see a lot of trafficking, they start developing their laws. It's in the last 3 or 4 years when you've actually seen really strong laws in these countries against trafficking for the first time. So that gets them to tier 2, but to get to tier 1, they have to start enforcing it. And that's where we come mm-hmm. in as an organization and start enforcing it. So, mm-hmm. so that's been one of the major problems is just ignorance and unwillingness to look and unwillingness to enforce. The other major problem is the demand. I mean, why does a man, and I say a man because 99% of the time that's who it is, why does a man want to have sex with a child? I mean, why would you want to engage in this thing? I mean, this is, we're talking, like I said, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old girls and boys. Why do you want this? It's a sex addiction. And where does that sex addiction come from? It comes from, in my mind, it comes from pornography. And I worked, I mean, most of my career, I've worked on child pornography cases. And you see what pornography does. I've studied a lot about it. I've interrogated dozens and dozens of guys who we end up arresting for child molestation and possession and distribution of child pornography. And how do you get to this? And they all have the same story of, you know, I was 15 years old. I picked up my first Playboy. And from there, and if you study what pornography does to the mind, it actually affects the mind like a hard drug, like cocaine or heroin would. It's a chemical reaction that the guy wants. And after, you know, a decade or more, or, you know, of looking at regular pornography, the chemical reaction slows down just because your body becomes immune to it. Like a marijuana user, you know, eventually it's going to slow down and they need something else, something more powerful, something more potent to get that chemical reaction. And these guys, oftentimes when I interrogate them, you know, they said, you know what, when I was in my 20s or 30s, I had zero desire to look at a 7-year-old girl being raped. I didn't want that. But I needed the chemical reaction because my body needed it so badly. I needed to shock my system with something. So I turned to, usually they turn to bestiality and child pornography just to get that. And once they're into that world, now they want to try it out for real, and they start traveling to these countries where they know there's little consequence for engaging in illicit sex with children, and they go down there, and that's what creates the demand. I mean, if there's 2 million children today in the commercial sex trade, that number, to justify that number, you need a pretty significant demand. And that's a sickening thought. How many people want that to justify 2 million children? And so that's what's happening. I see that as the problem. You would be shocked if you saw how many child pornography cases there are all over the world every single day. People trading and enjoying this material where the kids are prepubescent and they're watching these kids be raped. It's devastating. It's unbelievable.
Well, even applying simple math to it, you have 2 million minors involved as victims of sex slavery. It's not like it's a one-to-one equation. There's got to be multiples. Yeah,
exactly. That's what's so sickening. That's what's so sickening.
That's terrifying.
These kids are raped. I mean, we deal with the victims, and they'll line these kids up, and they'll be raped 10 times a day. If you watch the movie Taken, I mentioned the hard kidnapping is not something you see a lot, but how it functions, where they drug these kids up and they just stick them in places. And I say kids, but women also. And that's a pretty accurate description in that movie, where they just throw them in there and force them just to take client after client all night long.
Ugh. Oh man, that's awful. Oh.
Do you have a personal question, and they can edit it out. Do you have children of your own?
I do. You don't have to edit that out. Yeah, I have six children.
Is this hard for you to do?
Oh,
when you see children,
it's so hard.
I have children.
I've been doing my oldest is 14, and my youngest is 5. So So every victim I come across, the first thing I do when I see that victim is I say, that is my daughter's age. That is my son's age. Cause I have all the ages right there.
Yeah.
And I can't help. I try not to. I can't help seeing my own kids' eyes in these kids every time, every single time. And it's a punch in the stomach every single, I've been working these cases for over 12 years, and I cry more, not less.
Man.
Are you seeing that you've made any sort of a dent? I mean, has there been any progress made? And you talked earlier about the tier 2, tier 1 from the, what was that that you called that?
The trafficking in persons report.
The tip report. Have you seen any progress in the work that you've done in the 12 years? Good.
Yes, Yay! We have. Yeah, we have. And one reason I left the government to work privately is I knew we could do something that was not being done. See, the biggest problem I had, the CHIP report was a great thing coming out of the United States, but the problem was the enforcement piece. So these countries get the laws, and then they're like, well, help us. Like, can you guys help us do this? These bad guys are selling to Americans, so we need American undercover operatives to come down and play this role. And when I was a government agent, I would get requests from these governments who are trying to get out of tier 3 or tier 2. And I tried my hardest to get down there, but the problem is I couldn't get support 9 times out of 10 unless I could show that there's a U.S. citizen involved, a U.S. child involved, or a U.S. sex traveler involved. And you can't prove, you can't do that. You've got to just go to the kids. And then from there, you can maybe find that. Well, and if I could prove it, I couldn't get support or resources because it wasn't a U.S. case. It was a Colombian case or a Mexico case or a Thai case. And so I got so fed up with being told no when I knew where the kids were, and I knew there was a government willing to work the case. They just needed a little help. That's why I left, so we could just plug into any jurisdiction and start working.
So, Tim, tell us how did you get started with a job where you're working against the sex trafficking world?
I actually never – it's funny, when I was in the academy and I was in school, I always wanted to be a government agent fighting crime, international crime. I really was interested in that, but not child crime. I wanted to fight terrorists and drug traffickers, and I studied everything I could to prepare myself to do that. and I got the dream job I wanted. You know, I was stationed at the place I wanted to be, right on the border of Mexico. I had an office that looked into Mexico. I was crawling through drug tunnels, and my first 6 months was just what I had hoped. And then they called me in and they said, look, we're starting a child crimes unit. And this was early 2000s when the thought of a child crimes unit was just barely being born, which is a sad fact. And the U.S. was the first to start creating anti-child trafficking, you know, units and things like that. And I was asked to come on, and I was devastated because I said no. This is the one thing I promised my wife, and my wife made me promise to her that I would not do, because I knew the darkness. And that's why I understand why there's not been a great response. I was part of the problem, you know. I don't want to see it. Who wants to see this? Who wants to talk about it? It's hard talking about it right now, you know, on this program. I mean, it's hard, dark, heavy stuff. And so I said, no, I don't want to see it. I don't want to deal with it. And I kind of walked away, and it took me about 24 hours and talking and praying and meditating over it with my wife. And we decided that, how can I say no to this? How can I, when you picture there's children, I look at my own children. It's funny because initially my wife and I said, we can't do this because we have kids, you know? And then by 24 hours later, it was, we can't not do this for the same reason we thought that we, you know, because we have kids.
Yeah.
And so I went back to my boss and I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll try it. And instantly the first thing they do is have you take a psychological test, and they assign a shrink to you. So that's not very promising when your first, the first thing they give you to do before you start a case is, here's your shrink, because you're going to need it.
Yeah.
You're going to need this number. Don't lose it.
Counseling on retainer.
Yeah.
Speed dial.
So they weren't kidding. I mean, one of the very first cases I worked, I almost dropped out of the group. We came across this horrible video of a little boy, 5 years old, who was just being just raped. And come to find out later, there was 12 other kids that this American guy in San Bernardino, California, a wealthy contractor, his name was Earl Buchanan, and anyone can Google that guy, and he's in jail forever. But he was smuggling kids in from Mexico, and raping them in his home and videotaping everything. So we come across the video. We end up finding him crossing the border from Mexicali into California, and I was called down to the border when we pulled this little boy out of the van, and there he was, and it was just, there's the kid from the video, and he comes and he runs to me and he jumps in my arms. I'm the first one that he sees, and he kind of inherently just recognizes we're the good guys. And I remember how hard he held on to me, and he was just shaking. And he said, help me, I don't belong here. Help me, I don't belong here. He said it in English. So he, you know, and I just broke down. It was a July 3rd, I remember. And so by the July 4th, Independence Day, we had enough evidence to hit the guy's compound up in San Bernardino, and subsequently found 12 other kids. This guy had cameras in every room, bathrooms, everywhere.
Oh my goodness.
He had pornography mixed with toys, you know, and just to desensitize these kids. And I remember coming home after 48 hours of no sleep and not seeing my family. And I walked in my house, and I'll always remember, I literally collapsed on the floor. I just felt, and my wife didn't know where I'd been or what had been going on. I collapsed on the floor and just started sobbing like a baby, like just uncontrollably. And she just comes to me, just holds me like, what in the world just happened? Like, what happened? And I said, I told her, I don't think I can do this. I cannot do this. It was so painful. But somehow that experience, instead of dissuading me, in the end was the thing that encouraged me. And I thought, you know what? I can do this. I have to do this. I've got to find it somewhere. I've got to find the courage to do this, because there's millions of little Jose. This little boy's name was Jose. There's millions of little Jose's out there, and no one's looking for them. And so that was the case where I just kind of turned it all over to the Lord. I mean, I got I was religious before. I got super religious after that, and just said, I need your help, and I need to just do this. And the cases didn't get any easier, but it was just shocking to me to put real faces to these numbers, you know, of 2 million, you know, and millions of slaves, to put faces to that and actually see how easy it is to find these kids. And then that's what led me, you know, about 10 years later to start this organization, because I recognized that most of the 2 million, no one's looking for them, because the developed nations like the United States and others, they actually do a pretty good job protecting the U.S. kids, and they do a pretty good job going after the U.S. perpetrators. But that only accounts for a small percentage of those 2 million, and no one is looking for them. And I learned that along my path, along my journey, that no one was going to find that was even trying to find those kids. And that's why I left to start Operation Underground Railroad, to go find those lost kids that no one was looking for.
Oh, well, that, you know, that sounds like it needed to happen, Operation Underground Railroad. So how did that get founded? Who are the founders? How'd you get that together? Was that just you, or who put it together with you?
It was the scariest thing I ever did in my life. I mean, it was terrifying to me. Sometimes I get uncomfortable. You know, we've had a lot of media. I've been on most, I think every national show, and I'm uncomfortable sometimes because they paint me as this like hero figure. And it's like, guys, know the truth. I did not go into this with my sword unsheathed. I mean, I was in the fetal position for most of December of 2012 or 2013, because I had made the commitment that I was going to do this. And then once the money started dropping, I told my wife, I feel like Jonah, like I want to just hide now, because I am so, you know, I have 6 kids and I'm thinking about their college. I'm like, what am I doing leaving this nice job that I have? I'm going to go to run a nonprofit organization with no experience doing this. But how it happened was the media personality, Glenn Beck, which is interesting, very, you know, very divisive. Mm-hmm. People love him or hate him. And I didn't frankly care about whatever his politics were. What I did care about was that he found out what I was thinking about doing, and he flew in to see me. And he said, how can I help you do this? This human trafficking is something that keeps me up at night, and I wish there's more we could do. And so he started, he went to his fans. And, you know, he vetted me out to make sure I knew what I was doing, and I convinced them that I knew exactly what I was doing. And then he went to his fans and his audience. He just said, this was in November of 2013. And he just said, look, I know these guys, they want to save kids. They have a way to do it. And I couldn't come out yet because I was still a government agent. So I couldn't come out and convince people who I was or how I was going to do it. And his audience just believed him. And I got to give it to him for sticking his neck out like that, because if I didn't follow through or come through in the end, he would have really had a problem with his hands. But he ended up in just a month or two raised several $100,000 in the first couple of weeks, actually. And that was it. And I was like, I got to go. I got to jump. And then after that, once we did it, we had our first couple of cases, and then that got media attention, and then it started spreading to other media outlets. And so our donor base, we don't have like this some angel donor who came in. Our average donation is $50.
Wow.
In mass. And that's, it's been the media, that's kept us in business. And so with every operation we did, and we've had, I mean, we've saved, our organization has saved more kids in 2014 than I even heard about. Not that I saved, but even heard about being saved in my whole 12 years working these cases in the government.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
We pulled out, and these are the victims that we actually saw and beheld and pulled out, over 240 in 2014. And that number actually is much higher, because we dismantled entire organizations. And what we did that's more important than that is, for example, we went into Colombia. That was one of the first countries we went into. We had four operations there and rescued dozens and dozens of child victims. And what it did was it inspired the Colombian government, and they got the press and they took the credit. We told them, you guys did this. This is your case. And all of a sudden we pull out of Colombia and they do five more operations in a couple of months following our model, saving dozens of kids without us. And it was, and then we went back into some of the cities in Colombia months later that we worked in, and with different American faces, and started up like we were going to do what we did before, which is basically, you know, you go to the street vendors, and about probably over half of the street vendors know the traffickers. And so if you ask the right question, they lead you to them. Every single street vendor we went to said, don't you know these Americans came down a couple of months ago? They all got arrested. And he said, everyone's running scared. No one's selling kids. Don't ask. And it was just this like moment. And I had an undercover Colombian agent with me, and we both kind of got teary eyed as we looked at each other and thought, this, look what happened. You know, you guys, and look what you guys did. I mean, you guys have created this wall of deterrent that has never existed. People are scared for the first time to sell kids. And so we're going to keep going into every country and doing that. Or when we leave, these guys are off and running and saving kids by themselves.
That's amazing.
That's great. So you gave us a little bit of a sneak peek there, where you go in undercover and you start talking to the street vendors. Take us through an operation, and from beginning to end, how do you target an area? Do you just go in anywhere and start talking to street vendors, or do you do things ahead of time, and then how does it carry on from that point?
So the most important part to start with is that we always work with the governments. We're not a vigilante group. We're not a rogue organization. We go in the front door or we don't go in. And so we find the right people. I rely on my embassy contacts to tell me who are the trustworthy law enforcement and prosecutors in this city or this country that I can trust. And they always know who it is because they've been there. They know who they've worked with. So they say, if you work with this prosecutor and those five cops, then you're going to be just fine. So then we get introduced to them. Then we sit down with them and say, look, guys, you know kids are being sold to Americans down here. So just tell us where to go. Where is it happening? And they always know. These guys, they know their country. They know where it's happening. So, for example, when we went to the Colombians, they said, you know, there's a series of islands called the Rosario Islands, about an hour boat ride off of Cartagena. Kids are trafficked there, and we've never done anything about it. We don't even know what to do or where to start. So we go out to these islands, exactly where they told us to go. Beautiful, beautiful place. Kind of just this very ironic, kind of weird, where it's this gorgeous place, yet this dark, dark place. Because we roll up on this beach. It's called Playa Blanca. And just classic Caribbean style waters, you know, just a couple of resorts, but kind of primitive too. And we roll in there, and not 30 minutes pass, and this guy calling himself Fuego approaches me and starts asking me what can he get for me. And he starts running down the line, you know, drugs. I got cocaine. I got heroin. I got girls of all ages. I'm like, really? I said, what do you mean by all ages? And we're very careful about entrapment issues. We let them and we let them hang themselves, you know. So we just ask questions when they bring something up. And by the way, we're filming everything we do from seven different angles. And that gets into the documentary that they've made about us, which we can talk about later. So we're cameras rolling, hidden cameras. And I said, what do you mean all ages? He says, well, I can get you girls as young as 10 years old immediately, if that's what you want. And I thought to myself, this is unbelievable. I mean, these guys, this is the place. This is a trafficking hub that no one has done anything about, which gives this guy Fuego the confidence to come up to me and within 20 minutes and tell me he's got a 10-year-old girl I can rape without me having to really even push him at all. So at that point I say, well, that's why I'm here. He's like, that's what I figured. That's why Americans come here. I said, okay, so what I want to do is I want to have a party. I have to leave tonight, but I want to have a party and bring all my friends back here. So I want all of the kids that you got. And of course we do this so that we can plan and we can get the Colombians on board, but mostly so that we can make sure we save, you know, we maximize on this operation and get as many kids out as we can. So at that point, Fuego introduces me to his boss, the trafficker, whose name is Eduardo. Eduardo has a home on Cartagena, in Cartagena. And this is the most dangerous part of the operation. So I went home, I flew back with a small team several weeks later, and I walk into the home of Eduardo. And this is the dangerous part, because you're walking into his turf. And he's got these guards outside, and they're certainly armed. And we're wired up, and we go in with our hidden cameras. And this is where the undercover part, really, you've got to know what you're doing on the undercover side, because that's all you have. You go in there and basically just dominate the scene through your personality. And usually how we do that is just act like happy drunk guys.
Like Americans.
Exactly. like happy drunk Americans. Because if you act like that and you get them smiling, you get them just calm. And you act like you're super excited for this party, and they just can't wait to show you what they have. So then they pull up their cell phones and start showing us pictures of kids 10, 11, 12 years old and say, here's what I got. Here's what I got. And so Eduardo had 20 kids. And I said, oh, that's great, but I need more. I mean, can you get me more? And I know this is the point where Eduardo doesn't want to bring in the other traffickers because he doesn't want to lose business to them. And so at that point, we start trying to figure out a way to convince him to do that. And what we did was we got him talking about his desire to build a child sex hotel out in the Rosario Islands. I mean, these places exist, believe it or not. I mean, and so I said, well, you know what? My American friends, my investors, this is exactly what they want, is they want to build a hotel and bring people down. There's a lot of money in this. So we can be the investors. But you've got to show us that you've got more than 20 kids or we're not going to invest in this. At that point, Eduardo starts thinking. I'm looking in his eyes, and he's like, all right. So he lets in the other traffickers. He calls two of them to come in. And these two run modeling, the modeling school I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an example. They have the modeling school. That was their lure. So then I come back a couple weeks later and meet with all three traffickers. And now we have 55 kids that they're ready to commit for this party. So at that point, we go and rent. We go out back to the island because a lot of the kids are from the island. And we go out there and we rented a home on a private island. We don't tell the traffickers where the party is until like an hour before. We just tell them, go to this place, bring the kids, and we'll bring boats and take it from there. So we set this place up, and we had cameras everywhere, audio, video. We had Colombian cops posing as our waiters and as our housekeepers and as our taxi guides, our taxi driver's guides. And two huge boats come out, and 55 children come walking into our house. And we put them into a room. We have water and candy and all sorts of things for them. And then we negotiate with Eduardo and the other three traffickers. Fuego's there. We do the deal. Money exchanges hands. We make sure that they are very clear to us what each of these kids will do. And this is very difficult. You've got to get them. So otherwise, you know, the defense will, you know, they'll come back and say, this was just like a quinceañera. This was just a birthday party. You got to make sure that it's clear what we're giving money for. And we have ways to get that out of them and talk to them. And you know, for example, I'll say something like, look, I was at one of these parties before, and these kids, when we tried to touch them, they yelled and ran away. Is that going to happen here? And what that does is it encourages the traffickers to say, oh, no, you kidding me? Let me tell you what these kids are going to do. They're going to do this and that, and they're saying things that I would never repeat on this program, but that's what puts them away. And when the judge and the jury sees this, that's what's going to end this immediately. And so we get them to talk as dirty as we can to make sure that their heart and their intent is recorded. And then money's exchanged, and then we call in the teams, the takedown teams, and they come in on boats and take everybody down, arrest everybody. So that's one of our most recent ops, and it's very similar to how we do other ones. That's kind of how it goes down. We're also developing more of like a military group. We're actually getting our State Department designation right now that actually makes us a private military company you know, like Triple Canopy or, you know, these private companies mm-hmm. that provide security and stuff. It allows us to then contract with governments, and we wouldn't charge them but a dollar just for the contract. And now we can go in and start raiding with them. We can start raiding slave camps military style, bring in helicopters, drones, you know, high-end weaponry.
Wow.
And that's what a lot of these countries need, where there's a lot of slave labor, where it's just kind of open, and they hold kids in camps and stuff. So that's another angle that we're starting to implement this year. So,
so where do the kids end up once you've rescued them? Because if they've been separated from their family for a while and they don't have an address, you know, in their back pocket, where do the kids end up?
Great question. So we don't consider the kids rescued until they're, you know, rehabilitated and they're sure not to go back into this life. And so what we do is, before we even do an operation, we partner with another organization that specializes in rehabilitation. Ultimately, the country we're working in has the stewardship over these kids, but rarely are we satisfied with what we think they're going to do with them and the process. And so we tell our government partners that we are happy to do this, but they have to let this other group in that we have vetted out, that we have found. So in Colombia, it's called Renacer, to be reborn. And it's a private group like ourselves, a nonprofit organization. This one's funded mostly by the Canadian government, actually. But it's a private organization. It's Canada's version of USAID, you know, and they just have chosen this group. And so we sit with them and we tell them, look, we're going to rescue 50 kids this weekend. We can't tell you more details, but, you know, we'll bring them things. We brought 12 large duffel bags with all these supplies that we knew they would need. So we help them out and then make sure they're going to be there. And then on the heels of the takedown, Renacer comes in and immediately starts trying to identify these kids. Where are you from? Do you know who your parents are? And they'll start the process working with the Colombian government, working with us. We try our hardest to stay involved in that. Some governments, hey, look, you guys kind of did your part. We, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen. This is very sensitive, and they'll ask us to butt out, which is fine. I understand that they want to insulate this part that's very sensitive and bring only, you know, experts who have expertise in rehabilitation. Other countries let us be more involved, but what they do is ask the questions: where are your family? Do you know who your family is? Does your mom, or if they say yes, we do, we have homes here. Okay, well, does your mom know you're here? What's going on? And they'll start working with law enforcement to vet out the situation. And if it's an unsafe home environment, they're not going home. Oftentimes, they'll mm-hmm. find another family, a family member, distant in another city, perhaps, or another country, and they'll place them there. Or Renacer will just raise them if they have to. But they offer psychological help. They offer there's educators, there's doctors, and so we always make that a part of the process. In fact, we wanted to go do some operations in Mexico. We have a lot of connections there, but we just couldn't find the equivalent of a Renacer in Mexico. And so Ed Smart, who works for us, his job is rehabilitation. He's our director of rehab and prevention. So he's been working with – we actually found an organization in Mexico that we liked, but they just weren't very big. And so we've married some of our donors with this group and kind of built them up and brought them resources. So now they're at that point. We've been working with them most of last year. So now they're at that point. Now we're ready to go into Mexico because we have mm-hmm. a place that we can trust. If we can't find that – we have to create the safe haven first, before we will go in and do the rescue.
Yeah, you don't want to be rescuing the same kids over and over again.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So do you only go to Central and South America? Or are you going to other countries too?
We are going to every country. We started out there simply because that's when I was in the government, I was assigned to basically Spanish-speaking countries. I speak Spanish. I know that culture. So we kind of picked up where I left off, but now we're everywhere. We're working in almost every continent this year. So we're hitting Southeast Asia in a big way this year because that's a huge problem there. So yeah, we're going, we're worldwide. And in the United States, we're actually working. Actually, we've already had an operation in the U.S. And we're going to be doing more, here, especially in some of the more, smaller jurisdictions where the law enforcement doesn't have as many resources. Some of the smaller towns, cities, cities along the border that are small, where there's high trafficking. And they're more apt to let us work with them. You get too big, right, and these organizations think they don't want, you know, an NGO coming in and helping them. So there's plenty of jurisdictions that are in need here in the United States, and we're doing a lot of work there as well. So,
are you going to rescue the Boko Haram girls?
You know, we've talked about it.
Africa. Have you talked about it?
We've talked about it, and that's a different animal. We might need a couple more years to take on, because now you're not just taking on traffickers, terrorists at the same time. And we're working on it. We're getting there.
Well, good. Good. Because those girls have certainly been on my mind a lot for the last several months. So what is there that we can do to fight against child trafficking on a local level, on a national level? What can I do as Joe Schmo or Joan Schmo, I guess?
You know, I think the biggest problem is just the awareness piece, that people need to know this is real and it's happening. And I love history. I love American history. So I always go back to the example of the eradication of overt slavery in the United States. How did it go on for so long? Mm-hmm. And because people just didn't want to deal with it. The government wasn't the one that eradicated it eventually. Yeah, officially it did. But it was the people that said enough is enough. It was people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. People like Frederick Douglass, former slaves who came out and took their shirts off and showed the scars on their backs. And said, this is real. Open your eyes, people. This is happening. And enough people got stirred and converted that they rose up and became so loud that the government then had to act and had to do more. And that's what led us into the solution to the problem here that brought the eradication of slavery. And so it's a very similar problem in that the people need to get loud, and they won't get loud unless they know what's happening. So just talking about it, like what you're doing right here, is talking about it, getting it out, tweeting it, you know, using social media, telling the stories, getting people engaged in this. We don't pretend to be the solution. We're not going to save 2 million kids, but what we can do is facilitate the awareness piece by taking you there, showing you what's happening. And that's where this big component comes in, where we were approached by Jerry Mullen. Jerry Mullen's the producer of Schindler's List, Oscar winner,
right.
Jurassic Park and other big movies. He came to us early on. In fact, before I had even left the government, because Glenn Beck was talking about us and he had heard through that. And he came to me and he said, I would like to send a team to follow you around and have, so people can see what's going on, see this problem. And he said when they made Schindler's List, they were shocked at the overwhelming response from people, that they didn't really know what had happened in during the Holocaust. And he thought to himself back then, when he made that movie, what if we had made this movie? What if it was possible that we had made this movie in 1941 or 1942? How many lives might have been different? How many lives might have been saved? Because we could have injected this passion in these people while it was happening, and they could have, you know, stood up and said no. And he said to me, we have the chance to do that for this problem. We can make the Schindler's List for human trafficking in the 1941 of that problem right now while it's happening. And so they did an amazing job. They followed us around, and our first two or three operations they put together, and it's a documentary that will be out. It'll be out in theaters very soon. They're right now, they're in Hollywood negotiating deals with major studios And it might even flip into a TV show. Mm-hmm. So they still film us. They've filmed every operation we've done, every last second. And they're still following us around. And I think this is going to be a great piece, you know, because it shows people what it is. And they can't, and basically make it. We want to do what Harriet Beecher Stowe did, where she made them look at it. Like, here's the book and read it. And it took off. You know, she sold 7 million copies in the first year. And people said, really? This is really happening? And that's what began the movement. So we are trying to begin that movement. I think this documentary, it's called The Abolitionists. We hope it'll have that, that same effect.
Awesome. Gosh, you must be a lot of fun in gospel doctrine class. right. There's Brother Ballard again talking about child trafficking.
Yeah, my poor wife, she's always grabbing my arms like, you can't talk like that. These people, they're not desensitized like you are to this. Not that I am in some respects, I'm able to talk about it, but I got to be careful. I know, because I'm a little, you know, too clear sometimes.
Maybe just clear enough. Okay, so looking forward to the movie, documentary, maybe the TV show coming out.
If you go to theabolitionistmovie.com, you can. There's a great trailer. Really, they did a really good job, and it does a really good job representing what the movie's about. It's theabolitionistmovie.com, and right there is like I said, an awesome about 2 minute trailer. That's pretty inspiring, I think.
I watched the news bit on ABC earlier today to get ready, and that was, even just that little bit, was actually really moving.
Yeah.
So.
Is that the Nightline piece?
Yeah, the Nightline. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the website for the group is the Operation Underground Railroad, correct?
That's right. It's OUR Rescue, OurRescue.org, two R's, OURRescue.org.
And is that the place where if someone wants to donate to support your organization, that's where they would go?
Exactly. That's where they'd go. And we have a What Can I Do section that's, you know, donating is just one thing. There's lots of different ideas that we give people to go out and get the word out and do and volunteer. And so it's a great place to go if people want to help out and learn more.
Thanks, Tim, for coming on and talking to us and educating us about this awful problem, really, that's going on. And hopefully we can be of help some way, at least in spreading the word and helping more people become aware.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
So now that we've gone through the interview, have you read anything before this interview? Have you read anything or heard anything about sex trafficking and you know, how large of a problem it is? You know, what's been your exposure to this problem?
Yeah, I have, sadly, not a lot of experience. I mean, from differing movies and films and stuff.
Taken, like you mentioned.
Yes, like Taken. That was kind of one of the first times that I really was exposed to that. But also a little while ago, I read an article from Tim Ballard where he was, as was kind of discussed in the interview, you know, that idea was just so powerful. Like that, he was just talking about how so many people will talk about how if we had been alive during like American slavery, you know, during those time periods where a lot of that was going on, we would object to it, we would be opposed, we wouldn't have stood for it, and yet slavery is occurring right now in the world that we're living in, and it kind of just passes us by. We don't really notice. And sometimes there's little things like as you're saying, like Taken or some of these things that point it to us. But it's really shocking to kind of realize that these kind of terrible things are going on.
Yeah, and the problem is they're so separated from our day-to-day life in middle-class America that, you know, unless we're aware of these people traveling to, you know, for this purpose of, you know, going on sex tours or whatever they are, that, you know, we're just not aware of them. And so I think this interview is one of the more important interviews we've done. Because, I feel like this one, how I feel about the Liahona Children's Foundation, because we just aren't aware of the suffering and the problems that, without doing some exploring, we're not aware of the things that are going on outside of our everyday experience and lives that are similar to ours. You know, we hear about the quote-unquote trauma, and I don't mean to minimize that, of faith transitions and things like that. But, you know, this is the malnutrition, this is the real deal. This is like some of the worst suffering in the world, period. Yeah. So this is something that we need to get more comfortable talking about and standing up for, I think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just kind of going with the Liahona Children's Foundation, I think that's so important to think about, how there's all of these different issues and we can get so upset with them. But kind of, I love thinking about Bob Reese and just this idea, and like individuals like Tim Ballard and some of these people who see these problems, and instead of just complaining about them, they're actually doing something to make the world a better place. They're doing something to really try to attack these serious issues, and I think it's so inspiring, and it's really a really important reminder to me that, you know, and I need to be doing more than complaining on the internet, you know, about certain things. I need to try to be making an actual difference in the world.
Yep. And we can do that in small ways. I mean, even by sharing this interview and sharing the trailer to the Abolitionists documentary that's supposed to be coming out soon. I think that's a small thing that we can do, but it's something that we can do. So I'd like to close with that thought. Instead of talking about announcements or whatever, we can send out a post or Facebook announcements for the next podcast. But let's just end with that on our minds.
I knew that night that the rest of my life would be spent rescuing and saving these little girls.
Our best weapon is our stealthiness and our ability to really trick the bad guy.
Oh,